Everybody, have your Bible open to 2 Kings 17. This is my pick for the chapter of the week in our daily Bible reading. And this chapter I've chosen because of how thought-provoking it turns out to be. This chapter is the inspired explanation for what happens in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. And if you ever are a person who reads through these accounts of these various kings and their dealings and their tragedies and their triumphs and all of that, and if you have trouble sorting out which one's from the southern kingdom and which one's from the northern kingdom and which one's a good guy and which one's a bad guy and all that kind of thing, then this chapter is an effective summary for that. That, however, is not the only reason why this is a thought-provoking chapter to me. This is also a chapter that raises questions about God's sovereignty in dealing with nations and the rise and fall of nations and how He disciplines, how He exercises His judgments within history, which the Bible teaches that He does. And then I'm interested in reading this chapter as to what the parallel is to what we're reading about here. Is it any of the particular nations in the world today, or is it the church? Because you see, 2 Kings 17 is about the fall of the northern kingdom. Which means that for a period of about 200 years or something like that, maybe 210 years, from about 930 B.C. until 722 B.C., we have what usually we refer to as the period of the divided kingdom. From the death of Solomon until the fall of Samaria, the fall of the northern kingdom at the hands of the Assyrians. During that time, there are several different dynasties who hold power in the northern kingdom. Always in the southern kingdom, there is a descendant of David on the throne. But in the northern kingdom, the families who are in rule change over and over again, and usually it's because of a coup or an assassination or some such thing as that, and it's a period of upheaval of the worst kind through the whole time. And I'm going to show you in just a minute that what happens here is not predetermined by God, but it is predicted by God. He foreknew what would happen. So to what degree is this just God's dealing with a covenant people, which would parallel the church? And to what degree is God's dealing here to be parallel with, say, how He might in His providence deal with our nation, which is not a covenant people of God, but still is a national entity in a world which still belongs to God? That's, to me, a very interesting question. And then with that in mind, what kinds of things happen that do bring God's judgment on these people? Today, we'll read and let you guys, actually let you guys talk some, so be prepared for that. And I want to, for you to try to remember, you might look in the first part of this chapter to see what I'm getting at, that these things happen while it looks like it's business as usual to the people themselves. To the people themselves, if you read chapter 17, the neighbors, Judah and Syria, are going through their own difficulties, and this causes political intrigue of various sorts within Israel, the northern kingdom herself. Hoshea becomes the king in Samaria, and during this time, the Assyrian power off here to the northeast from Israel is becoming stronger. Shalmaneser comes, and who's the Syrian king at the time, comes and forces the Israelites to pay him tribute. In other words, it's like a bully saying, I'll let you have your own country as long as you pay me an exorbitant tax for so doing. And when the Israelite king gets tired of that, he sends an emissary down to Egypt, forms a political tie with Egypt, thinks that somehow his having a friend will help him withstand the Assyrians and so forth. This sounds like the normal workings of national powers, trying to figure out how to play chess on the chessboard of international life. And the king of Syria invades the land in verse 5, and in verse 6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, which, as I say, is 722 or 721 B.C., it says the king of Assyria captured Samaria, carried Israel away into exile in Assyria, to Assyria. And he tells where he settled them, in the cities of the Medes, which would be the neighborhoods today that are in Iraq and places like that are still so much in the news. Now, I want to point out to you that this event has been predicted ever since 1 Kings 14 and verse 15. Turn back over there if you want to. 1 Kings 14, verse 15. This is during the early time of the very first king of the northern kingdom. You remember who he was? Rehoboam ruled the southern kingdom, and Jeroboam was this first king. Remember, Jeroboam's child became sick, and he sent his wife to Ahijah the prophet in Shiloh in verse 2 to find out what was going to become of them. Ahijah could not even see. His eyes were dim with age, but he hears Jeroboam's wife coming and knows who it is and tells her what to go tell Jeroboam. And in verse 15, this is the part that has to do with the fate of the nation. John, read that for us, please.
The Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and root up Israel out of this good land that he gave to their fathers, and scatter them beyond the Euphrates, because they made their Asherim, provoking the Lord to anger.
All right, because they have made their Asherim, because they have already set the direction, their direction toward or according to the idolatry of their neighbors and not according to their covenant with God. Which makes me ask this question according to this verse. Why is this prediction made? What is the ultimate reason why the Lord is going to uproot Israel from this good land he gave to their fathers? There is an answer to this question. I give you a hint. It has to do with Deuteronomy and Exodus and so on.
It might be of the blessings and the curses.
That's right. This is according to the terms of the covenant that God made from the beginning. He told them, if I give you the land, and you choose other gods, or you start doing what the nations that I cast out before you have done, then I will cast you out like I did them. So what this prophet is saying is simply that God would be obligated to be faithful to the covenant himself, even if the nation was not. And that would mean that if they forsook his steadfast love, then he would scatter them among their neighbors. And this is what's happening here. So now we have, back to 2 Kings 17, the why Israel fell question. This starts in verse 7. Verses 24 and following tells about the resettling of the land, the northern kingdom itself, by the king of Assyria. So what we're mostly interested in is verse 7 through 23. Let's break this down and try to think our way through it if we can for a few minutes. I would like for us to read the verses 7 and 8 to start with, and I'm going to tell you the things that I've underlined in my study in this, and see what you think of it. Brendan, start with 7 and 8 for us.
Now this came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up from the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods, and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel, and in the customs of the kings of Israel, which they had introduced.
All right. Now, I find three themes running through that introduction to why they were cast out. First, it was because Israel sinned against the Lord their God. Now, what is in the middle part of verse 7, what is the disgraceful act which produced their sin against the Lord God? All right, they did that. I want to think of the deeper issue before that. What did they have to forget in order to do everything else they've done?
Oh, it was God who brought them out.
All right. And what sin is it when someone does you a great honor, blessing, and favor, and then you walk away from that? There's a word for it. It's ingratitude. They owe God their existence. But they instead, and this is what Gene just said a moment ago, they feared other gods. Now, what did it mean to fear other gods? To worship them. One of the alternate translations would be to revere them, to adore, to honor, to respect other gods. So you have someone who brought you up out from the gods of Egypt, and you, instead of being grateful to him, you give your heart, your devotion to other gods. And then, verse 8, what's the third thing added to this? What does it mean to walk in the custom, to walk in something? They lived their lives like. To walk in the customs means their way of life now becomes something that you can't separate. You can't tell the difference between them and the nations who know nothing about God. Eddie?
It's also interesting to me that even though they feared other gods, God was in that group. And so to me, that's...
We'll talk about that a little bit more. But you're right, making God one of the other nations. Now, here's the question. These nations, now that they're imitating, what had happened to those nations?
They're gone.
Why?
because, first of all, the Israelites proved going out by the power of God.
All right. By the power of God is the main problem. It says, the Lord, whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel. So you can see the pure lack of historical perspective and understanding in what's going on. The ingratitude and the unwise choices that are made here in every way. Now look at verses 9, 10, and 11 next. 9, 10, and 11. Adam, do you have those? Do you like to read or not?
No, but
okay. Appreciate it. 9, 10, and 11.
And the people of Israel did secretly against the Lord, their God, things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves pillars and Asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they made offerings on all the high places, as the nations did whom the Lord carried away before them. And they did wicked things, provoking the Lord to anger.
All right. And would you, since you're doing a great job, read verse 12 also.
And they served idols, of which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this.
All right. Now, you think about that passage there. First off, with what attitude is all the rest of it done? I'm thinking of the first part of verse 9 here. It's one of you said it. Say it out loud. You tried to say it secretly, so what were you saying? They did things secretly which were not right against the Lord God. What attitude does that involve?
They know it's wrong.
They know it's wrong, but they do it anyway. Why do they do it? What does it? What attitude or what spirit toward God does it take to do this?
They didn't think God would help.
All right, exactly. They believed that God was small enough that he would not pay attention to or would not be aware of or would not do anything about what they were doing. So this in itself is a disgraceful attitude toward God. It is a disgraceful statement about human nature that we are sometimes willing to do things that are wrong provided we think no one will know, right? And that's a relationship breaker in so many ways. Now, in particular, what sin is the nation charged with in this section that we've read? In one word, what's their sin?
Idolatry.
Idolatry, that's right. And notice that it takes, these are things they've built for themselves, middle of verse 9. They've done this from the smallest watchtower to the greatest fortress, end of verse 9. These things have included various sorts of statues or markers or whatever, sacred pillars, the images of the Canaanite's fertility goddess on every high hill and every under green tree. It's how pervasive this is. They've burned incense like the nations before them did, and these were things that were evil. They served idols concerning which the Lord said, "You shall not do this thing." What were the first of the Ten Commandments directed toward?
Have no other gods.
All right. Have no other gods before me, number one. And number two, I think it was, doesn't the grave, no graven image come next? You shall not make any graven image for yourself. And so those two commandments came first with Israel because they would fashion whether Israel did all the rest of them. Do you think that this idolatry could have taken place in Israel without consequences in personal behavior, family life, moral choices, you know it couldn't, right? You know that. And so that's what is going on. Now, verse 13 is an important statement on why this has been allowed to go on so long and what God has been doing with guys like Elijah and Elisha and so forth. Verse 13, Michelle.
Yet the Lord has to fight against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, every seer, saying, turn from your evil way to keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants the prophets.
All right. Now, you think, notice the three terms, by the way, used for the prophets here. Prophets, seers, and my servants. Notice that. And the prophets, we learned here, had the job of trying to call people back to covenant loyalty with God. That was their task and so forth. And they went over and over again. God trying to tell the people what they were doing to themselves and to call them back to him. Now, verse 14, 14, 15, and 16 tells us what happened. Let's read 14 and 15 first. Michelle, go ahead if you would.
Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffened their necks like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. And they rejected his statutes and his covenants that he had made with their fathers, and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, became idolaters, and went after the nations who were all around them. Concerning him, the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them.
All right. The key phrase is, they did not listen. They stiffened their neck. Remember, even in the days of Stephen in the New Testament, his summary of Israel's life, and he's charging them with being a stiff-necked people. And this is the background of that. And then in verse 15, the middle of the verse there, I noticed that the New American Standard Translation says, and they followed vanity and became vain. Idolatry has an effect on the national conscience. You notice in these readings here that the opposite of belief in God is not unbelief. I keep reminding us of this. The opposite of belief is idolatry. It's not unbelief. And we have a majority of maybe the society in practical terms. Now, people don't self-identify this way, but when it comes to where our loyalties lie, we betray the fact that we are idolaters in some ways, more than we are unbelievers. We're devoted to having our own way, or to sports and entertainment, or to political power and agenda, or to education and knowledge, or to possessions and comforts. And you can see the same thing at work in the lives of these people. Now, how degrading can idolatry get? What does it mean that they followed these things and became like them? Well, look at verses 16 through 18 next. Linda, read that for us, if you would, please. 16 through 18. Okay, 2 Kings 17.
They abandoned all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made for themselves metal images of two calves, and they made an Asherah, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven, and served Baal, and they burned their sons and their daughters as offerings, and used divination and omens, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel, and removed them out of his sight. none was left but the tribe of Judah only.
All right, so there the fall of the nation becomes complete. And look at the degradation in progress starting in verse 16. They forsook, having started with idolatry, they forsook which of the commandments of the Lord? All of them. Is that a surprise to you? Do you need a hub that I call the fear of the Lord for life? I tried to show recently on a Sunday evening from Proverbs how important that idea is. You can't do the right things without a good reason. And this is the end. Notice how deeply ingrained their idolatry becomes. It includes molten images, which they make for themselves, which are images often, almost always, of one of the supposed deities of the nations, maybe a bull or a tree or that kind of thing. They made an Asherah, which was more like what we would call a totem pole type image of the Canaanite goddess of fertility. They worshipped all the host of heaven. What does that mean? The host of heaven. All right. Moon, sun, stars, what we sometimes call the heavenly bodies, as if these things have control of what goes on in life. That kind of thing. And then they served Baal, who was the disgusting Canaanite god of fertility, often represented by a bull and so forth, in which whose worship involved acts of immorality, and then the kind of things that you read about in verse 17. What does verse 17 say they did?
Sacrificed
their children, made their children pass through the fire. In other words, made them burnt offerings to some of these gods. Gods with a small g and a big smirk. You couldn't read this and say, well, God, why is God angry? Is God angry because he has been slighted? Or is it the case that a God who loves would be terribly offended at what's being done to the object of his love? I think you can see what I'm getting at here. The wrath of God is his judgment against that which betrays his own image, and which claims the right of his people. In Deuteronomy, when we were reading it in chapter 4 especially, it makes the image that I, the Lord, am a jealous God. Vengeance is mine, I will repay. What is God saying when he says I'm a jealous God? If not, I love my people. And I won't be indifferent when they are being ruined. That idea is there. So and you've got to contrast verse 17 with what we read a moment ago, what Michelle read in verse 13. God is sending his prophets, his servants, one after the other, to tell the people the Lord's will and to call them back to him. But what does it mean when it says they practice divinations and enchantments? What does that mean? They engaged in, here are the God's servants, the prophets, the seers of God's will in the faces of the people, but here are the people consulting witches and sorcerers and trying every whatever trick they can to communicate with the dead or foretell the future. or that kind of, can you see the ridiculous? The living God is served by the death of their children, and the will of the God who's been shouting to them through the prophets is sought by these disgusting efforts toward witchcraft and that kind of thing. And they sold themselves to do evil. In other words, that was, they're totally gone to this kind of thing. And so God removed them from his sight. Now, okay, Ruth?
Thank you. Did the average people do this? Or did the leaders that led them?
The average people, the leaders are so often a reflection of the average people. They could not exist if it weren't for the average people at least allowing it. And especially in a land like the Northern Kingdom, where there were these changes in dynasty that I mentioned over and over again, where the people were basically led by whoever could seize the power. The other part of this that remains unsaid is that eventually the people in the southern kingdom, Manasseh and Amnon especially, do these same things. And that leads to the Babylonian captivity in this case. Let me ask you some questions about this now. It is true, the land gets resettled, and then the people there tried, verse 33, to fear the Lord and to serve their own gods. That's called syncretism, S-Y-N-C-R-E-T-I-S-M, religious syncretism. And it is true that that happens. There is some thought that the people who inhabit the land become known as the Samaritans of New Testament times. I'm not sure that can be proven. But the questions that come up from them, is this meant to indicate to us how God's providence works with all nations, or is this a reflection of his covenant enforcement with a covenant people? I can't answer that. I don't know if you can or not. This is at least a story of sin against love, and a reflection of the fact that eventually love has to do something. In our culture right now, the phrase love wins is being thrown around more and more. In recent days, it's been done to reinforce the gay rights movement's agenda and that kind of thing. Love wins. What is overlooked is that love, God's love, what the New Testament calls agape, can't abide hate. Eros, which is the romantic, the physical love, the opposite, I mean, it can involve hate. And if you watch what's happening in our culture right now, you notice that God's kind of love winning may mean something quite different from what our culture wants to. What did it mean, that love wins with Israel? It meant God acted in keeping with his covenant. His love was steadfast. His purposes were not thwarted by their faithfulness. They missed out on it. But God moved on toward his ultimate will, which was redemption through Christ. And so give some thought to this great chapter. It's an amazing part of the Bible and explains a lot of the rest of it. Appreciate y'all being with us. Please do keep us in your prayers this week.